Welcome to the Can Be Now podcast. We are the best and easiest way to stay connected to what's happening in your hometown. I'm your host, Tyler Frankie. We have an awesome show lined up for you today. We'll be talking with giant pumpkin farmer Jim Sherwood. Wait, just to be clear, he's not a giant. He's just a normal-sized farmer. It's the pumpkins that he grows that are giants. Also, we'll be wrapping up our look at the history of the Canby Ferry, which, it's a ferry, so obviously we'll be talking about another car crash. But first, the news. Pine Place, a proposed six-unit subdivision on South Pine Street, came before the Canby Planning Commission last week. The developer had submitted a design for two separate structures containing three units each. The problem is that Canby has a local ordinance that prohibits the construction of attached single-family residences with more than one shared wall. If observed, this would essentially prohibit any townhomes in Canby that are larger than a duplex. But as Planning Director Brian Brown explained, it has been routinely ignored by the city for years. He said townhome developments are commonly built with more than two attached units, both in Canby and elsewhere. In fact, such configurations are often necessary to satisfy the standards of high-density residential zoning.
And being able to redevelop properties because of the lot sizes and such, you need to redevelop it as a minimum density of 14 units per acre. And it's oftentimes difficult to do that, and you need the freedom to utilize unique housing solutions.
The same conflict exists for the Canby Townhomes, a proposed development of 38 townhouse units on 13th and Ivy. The Pine Place subdivision was eventually approved by the Planning Commission with one vote in opposition that came from Vice Chair Larry Boatwright. He said he liked the developer's design, but he would vote against it because of the ordinance that's in place. He had some strong words for what he thinks should be done with the ordinance, as well as some of the city's other outdated directives.
I think you need to change the damn code. And we've been talking about this. We've had a lot of problems with some of this code. We talked about how many years old it is. Well, here's an example right here where our code's not keeping up with what the city council and the planning department thinks is right. So I say change it, and I will vote no.
Brown said that removing the townhome prohibition would be as simple as changing two words in the existing ordinance. But the amendment has to be approved through the state, a process that takes about 4 months. Let me just say that again. It will take 4 months to allow the city to change two words in their own municipal code book. Brown said he would get the process underway immediately. It starts with a minimum 35-day notice to the State Department of Land Conservation and Development. The man believed to have been responsible for a notorious string of bank robberies in the area earlier this year has been scheduled for trial in November. 23-year-old Diego Sanchez Lopez faces 5 counts of bank robbery for the thefts, which occurred between November 2017 and May 2018. The suspect was nicknamed the Froggy Robber for his short stature, 5'2", and his practice of jumping the counter to threaten bank employees with a knife. In all, Sanchez Lopez is accused of stealing more than $87,000 from 5 banks across Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington, and Columbia counties. Before his arrest, a robbery at Columbia Bank in Canby last October had also been considered a part of the Froggy Robber spree, but Sanchez Lopez was not charged with this crime. When asked why, a representative of the U.S. Attorney's Office would say only that the investigation is ongoing. Sanchez Lopez was caught after an attempted robbery at Wells Fargo in Hillsboro on April 30th. He allegedly jumped the counter, threatened tellers, and demanded money, and made off with over $33,000. He was chased down by 2 customers, Josh Merritt and Jonathan Hodges, who followed him and were able to get the attention of a passing police officer. His trial is scheduled to begin November 27th in federal court in Portland. The Canby City Council will meet this week to consider a zone change related to the Canby Townhomes Project, a planned development of 38 townhouse units on the corner of 13th and Ivy, across from Hope Village and the Canby Senior Center. The zone change is opposed by the Canby Planning Commission and Traffic Safety Commission, as well as numerous residents in the area, who are concerned about increased traffic, a lack of adequate parking, and the high density of the proposal. Complicating the city council's decision is the fact that the property was mislabeled on the city's zoning maps and other documents, and the developer spent thousands of dollars on the mistaken belief that the land was already zoned in a way that was consistent with his plans. If the city rejects the zone change now, it could potentially open them up to litigation concerning these costs. The council will also review an annexation request for 9.5 acres off Northeast Territorial Road and consider for final approval an engineering design contract related to the efforts to establish a railroad quiet zone in downtown Canby. For a full agenda, visit our website at canbynowpod.com. The council will meet at 7 p.m. Wednesday. Today is Jim Sherwood. He's a local farmer and a longtime member of the Pacific Giant Vegetable Growers. Their motto is, they are growers of obscenely large vegetables.
That's right.
Yeah, Jim, how you doing?
Good, good.
Good. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, yeah. Glad to do it.
Yeah. So, my first question, how did you get into growing giant vegetables, growing giant pumpkins when you were a kid? Did you just go in the local supermarket and see a normal pumpkin and, like, I can beat that?
Right. No, it's where I grew up. I grew up in eastern Washington and worked on a wheat farm, and it's like, no, I knew nothing about this world at all. It all happened. I worked for a local tree care company, and I had a younger guy working for me, and he invited me to his house to help him pick pumpkins after work. And it's like, well, it's like, all right, you know, I'll help you pick up pumpkins, right? And it's like, and we get over there, and this was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There was a bunch of 800-900-pound pumpkins, and I was just like, oh, my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
And then so I helped him. Back in the day, we didn't have equipment, so we had to roll it
all
over.
By hand.
Yeah, all by hand. I had four or five buddies come over, and we picked pumpkins that night. And then I went to watch him at his way off, the pumpkin way off, and then there were big pumpkins everywhere, and the competitive nature kicked in me, and because I work with trees and shrubs and vegetation for my career, it was like, you know, all of a sudden the wheels started turning in my head, and I figured I could build a better mousetrap, so to speak, and here I am 20 years later still doing it, so...
So we're out here at your farm.
Yep.
We're standing by an obscenely large pumpkin.
Right.
You were saying this one is about 1,600
pounds.
Yeah,
I would estimate this one at around 1,600.
It's like the size of a small elephant or so.
Yeah,
it's a very, very large vegetable. So what all does it take to grow a pumpkin this big? I assume besides exposing it to nuclear waste at some point.
Well, yeah, it's like we have a direct pipeline from Hanford.
Sure, right? Yeah,
so,
just put that
those
right
underground
the field.
Bunkers, yeah.
Nice.
No, it's actually a pretty simple formula. Number one, you have to have the right seed.
Mm-hmm.
These are...
They're not normal pumpkin seeds.
These are Atlantic Giant pumpkin seeds.
Okay.
These were a variety of pumpkin that were developed by a gentleman out of Nova Scotia, Canada, Howard Dill. And so he's been hybridizing these things for years. I manually cross these things. I know exactly the lineage on both sides of the mother and the father back 20 years.
Wow. That's so
and I hand pollinate everything to make sure that I bring in the genetic traits that I want.
Yeah. You baby and these guys. You were saying you cover them up at night.
They get covered all day long and they get a blanket at night. I play music for them all day long.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I don't
even
do that for my kids sometimes.
Right.
So.
But hopefully your kids don't get this.
I hope not. they're going to have to find a new place to live.
Right.
I'll send them here.
Right. They're more than welcome if they can pull weeds. Yeah.
Cool. So seed,
right? So it takes the right kind of seed, and this is from a seed that actually set a world record last year. So obviously it has some proven genetic traits to get big.
So it's parent did that?
Correct.
Okay.
Yep. And then the biggest part of this whole thing is the soil. I spend all kinds of time and energy and effort augmenting my garden soil, bringing in all sorts of different organic matters, soil testing, introducing organic fungi and bacteria.
Cool.
And
so it's a year-round thing.
It's a totally a year-round thing. And when we're not growing and the garden's resting, we spend the whole winter in social media talking about it, learning from other growers, figuring out what people did, trading, selling seeds. All of our clubs, there's probably 120 clubs worldwide, We're all part of the Great Pumpkin Commonwealth, which I used to be a member. I used to be the treasurer for. And we have auctions. The clubs have various auctions to generate
for the seeds
funds
and
for their events.
Yeah.
And we've had giant pumpkin seeds go for $1,500 a piece in an auction. So,
wow.
Yeah. And it's not unheard of to go for a couple hundred dollars.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you started to talk about, and I think if someone's never heard of giant pumpkins or whatnot,
right,
they wouldn't realize the community that even locally.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. We're part of a group called the Pacific Giant Vegetable Growers. Mm-hmm. It was founded in 2001. And basically it's a bunch of local growers. There's probably 150 of us between Oregon, Washington, and then some in California and whatnot, that all kind of get together at these events, bring their giant fruits and vegetables in.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then we have our competition, have a big party, and then during the off season, we trade seeds, swap stories.
Sure.
It's a great close-knit group of people.
Yeah. Yep. Awesome. Awesome. So you, for the Bowman's, Great Pumpkin Way Off.
Right,
you're one
right.
of the way off coordinators.
Yep,
you
I'm the way off coordinator for
yeah.
it, yeah.
So one thing I was wondering,
yeah,
what do you do, not that anyone around here would, but how might people cheat?
Well,
and how do you keep that from,
okay,
I'm picturing people with like a giant syringe.
No,
with, like,
well,
some...
and that's, you know, and the funny thing is about it, the Great Pumpkin Commonwealth, which oversees the weighing of all these events around the world,
mm-hmm.
they have a set of rules.
Yeah.
The pumpkins can't have a hole in them.
Okay. So you check the skin to
you
make
have
sure
to check
no,
the
screen,
every crack, the stem, the blossom. When we pick them up to take them to the scale, we check the bottoms.
You don't pick the heavy machinery.
We have
picks
machinery
them up.
Pick them up, yeah. And so they can't have holes in them because then there's a possibility somebody could have introduced something in there.
Gotcha.
They have to be sound fruit, so they can't have any rot or decay. And so it's like, it's really hard to get these things from seed to the scale
without
something going wrong.
Sure.
Because they're growing at peak growth rates up to 50 pounds a day.
Good grief.
You know, so a young first grader
a day.
Daily, you know,
wow.
And so what happens is they grow really fast and they develop, as you can see, they're not perfectly symmetrical.
Yeah.
And they develop all these bumps and cracks and crevices and
sure.
stuff. And if you get
they
one
sort
little
of get
part
flat on one side.
On the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't roll them.
Sure.
That's impossible.
Yeah.
And
probably
so.
Not healthy.
And, well, you get hurt.
Yeah. Not healthy
back.
For you.
Everybody's hurt their back on these things at
yeah.
one point in time or another. But, yeah, so it's like. It's just by the grace of God that we get these things to the scale.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is sometimes, and it's because, you know, we have to prune every day. I probably spend 2 to 3 hours a day in the pumpkin patch when I get home from work.
Yeah.
So starting middle of June, 1st of June,
you're out here.
Through the end of September, you know, and yeah, so it's a labor of love. I mean,
sure.
if we got paid by the hour, yeah, it's probably not a really good profession to get into. So,
what motivates you to keep doing this, to do all that work? Is it just the competitive
no.
spirit? Or?
Well, there is that, right? Mm-hmm. And initially, that's what it was. But when you see people's reactions that have seen these things for the first time,
yeah.
you included,
yeah.
you haven't quit smiling right. since we've stood here, right? And that's what it does.
Well, especially when you called the 1400 one a baby.
My baby one,
yeah.
right? Right. So, but until you've been driving down the freeway with these things in the back of your truck, and you get people drive by and you see the look on their face,
yeah.
they slow down.
That's a lot of fun.
Cell phones come out the window.
Hopefully
and you
not
just,
from the driver's side.
Yeah, but. right. But it's just funny. It makes people smile. And
yeah.
and it literally, you can't not smile at them.
Cool.
And really, that's what it's all about,
yeah.
to put these things up there. And,
sure.
you know, so, yeah, that's kind of what I really get a kick out of.
Awesome. Awesome. What's the biggest pumpkin you've seen personally?
I've actually seen weighed on the scale is 2,363 pounds. Which is the current U.S. record, not the world record,
was
but
that
it's
at
the
Bowman's?
Q. No, that was way down in Half Moon Bay, California.
Okay.
Last year.
Wow. That's a big pumpkin.
It was a very big pumpkin. It was awesome.
Who was the grower on that?
Joel Holland. He lives up in Puyallup, Washington.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. What happens to the giant pumpkins when they're done? You guys just make giant pumpkin pie?
No. You know, we've tried, but they're so...
Like a kiddie
pool.
Yeah,
right? They're so full of water that... I mean, they're not full of water. That would be illegal.
Right.
But the flesh is so wet.
Yeah.
That it takes forever to cook it down to the point where you can make it into a pie. So really they're not pie worthy. But what we do with them is, you know, we sell them for displays at shopping malls and whatnot. They get carved. There's a lot of professional carvers out there.
Mm-hmm.
They've been on TV shows. We will drop them from a crane. One of the things we like to do is we'll get like a 100-foot crane and we'll drop them onto a car or a swimming pool or whatever.
Yeah.
Once we pull the seeds out, we really don't care what happens to them.
Sure.
And but the best part is at the third week in October in Tualatin at the West Coast Giant Pumpkin Regatta, we carve them out, we put them in the Lake of the Commons in the middle of Tualatin, and we have a boat race. And we get in them and paddle them with kayak paddles and go as fast as we can,
which is not
very fast,
right.
Unless you're in a little 500 pounder. But I've rode a 1200 pounder before, and it took me a while.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of that.
It's a lot of fun. So
we're almost out of time. We used to have a giant pumpkin way off here in Canby. It's now at Bauman's
Farms. Yep.
Coming up here, you want to give people the details?
Yeah,
if they want to check it out.
Bauman's Farms this Saturday, October 6th. The weigh-off starts at 10 o'clock sharp. We should be done by 3 or 4 o'clock. In the midway, we stop. We drop the giant pumpkin into the swimming pool and have a good time. And then the big ones come. We've set like 3 world records at this event. So we don't know whatever's coming, but we're hoping we'll set another world record this year. You never know.
Cool.
But we'd love to see everybody come out.
Well, thanks so much, Jim. Really appreciate it. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with Canby. Then we'll be doing the second half of our look at the history of the Canby Ferry, including the story of the only couple known to have actually gotten married on the ferry. Stay tuned. Service at the Canby Ferry stopped in January 1946, when heavy rains and high waters ripped the ferry from its moorings and smashed it against a riverbank downstream. The damage was deemed irreparable, and there wasn't enough money to buy a replacement, so service was simply discontinued. But in 1952, a grassroots effort led by local business and civic leaders began working to bring the ferry back. On July 2nd of that year, Clackamas County agreed to reestablish service after a delegation of Cambyites presented a petition in favor, signed by over 800 citizens. The Canby Herald had a colorful description of that hearing, saying Clackamas County Judge Wallace R. Telford tried to keep strictly to the subject of the ferry, and several times interrupted speakers who seemed inclined to stray to other subjects. One opposition speaker was asked to get back on track when he announced he was going to tell the story of the three drunks. The audience never got a chance to hear that story. In other words, it was pretty much your typical public meeting. The new, improved Canby Ferry was put into service in the summer of 1953, following a dedication ceremony on the river. It was christened the M.J. Lee, after Millard Jerome Lee, M.J. to everyone who knew him, and also sometimes known as Mr. Canby. His is a story for another time. Suffice to say that he was the son of some of the town's earliest pioneers, the first white child born in Canby, as was often noted in the earlier days of newspapers, and a dynamic figure in its early history. Lee had died several years earlier, so naming the new ferry after him seemed a fitting tribute. Ora Lee Catley, his cousin and a noteworthy figure in her own right, christened the vessel by smashing a bottle of champagne over its hull. Many years later, her daughter would say she out-christened the Queen of England, referring to the fact that Elizabeth II often had to take several swings in her christening attempts, whereas her mother had done it in only one. The decision to reinstate the ferry was a bit unusual, because by the 1950s, Oregon ferries were already becoming a thing of the past. When Boone's Ferry was replaced by a bridge in 1954, it left only 3 ferries still operating on the Willamette: Wheatland, Buena Vista, and Canby, which is still the case today. But the Canby Ferry served a purpose, not only in giving motorists a much quicker and more direct route to Portland, but also for the local economy. Newspapers noted that the ferry trundled many a truckload of grain across the Willamette during harvest season each year. By the 1960s, the ferry had acquired the nickname of the Clackamas County Navy, as it was the only seaworthy vessel the county owned. Like any Navy ship, the first MJ Lee was equipped with its own lifeboat, although no one ever had to use it. One of the ferry operators during this period was Vic Hodel, who served as ferryman for 23 years. He became so well known for the pilot cap and red suspenders he wore that one regular rider asked if she could have his suspenders when he retired. He said that she could, and he made good on that promise when he retired in 1979. Needless to say, Hodel had some memorable experiences on the river. In 1959, he witnessed the only known drowning of a Canby Ferry passenger, when a woman's dog jumped overboard midstream and the woman went in after it. The woman was later rescued, but her dog, sadly, was lost. Hodel himself had some close calls. The ferry lost power and stranded him during the infamous Columbia Day storm of 1962. Fortunately, some tugboat operators happened along and towed him to shore. Twice the vessel was struck by lightning while he was aboard, and he saw sparks flying off the steel deck. The worst happened in 1979, the same year he retired, which may not have been a coincidence. An approaching driver mistook the gas pedal for the brake and plowed into the ferry with her pickup truck. Hodel had to dive into the river to escape injury. "It sounded like an airplane coming down on me," he recalled. The only known wedding on the Canby Ferry happened on July 3, 1982, when Gresham residents Deborah Schlosser and Kurt Terhar tied the knot on the MJ Lee before a local magistrate. The couple had wanted a private ceremony. In fact, they hadn't even told their parents yet. But word leaked, and a whole crowd of wedding crashers, including public officials and photographers, was waiting for them when they showed up in tux and gown. The party was too large for everyone to fit aboard the ferry, so the ceremony was conducted with the boat moored. When asked about the honeymoon, the bride quipped, "We're not telling anyone where we're going." The Canby Ferry was the setting of a national TV commercial for Dodge Automobiles in 1987. The ad told the story of a young man driving all night in his new Dodge to see his girlfriend, who meets him at a ferry. Shooting had been set for the Puget Island Ferry near Seattle when the producer heard about the Canby Ferry from a waiter at a Portland restaurant. He drove over to take a look and decided that the MJ Lee was just what he'd had in mind. The production took 9 days to film and was estimated to have dropped $250,000 into the local economy. After 40 years of service, the original MJ Lee eventually fell into disrepair. In 1995, the ferry failed a Coast Guard inspection, and county officials began plans to replace it. The new MJ Lee cost $720,000 and was put into service in 1997. Doris Catley Martin, the daughter of Ora Lee Catley, did the christening honors. Canby and the surrounding community came together on September 17, 2014 to celebrate the Canby Ferry's centennial anniversary with speeches, ferry rides, fun facts, music, and the unveiling of a commemorative plaque. Descendants of MJ Lee were in attendance. For our Out and About segment this episode, many residents have noticed this week the new mural taking shape on the back of the old police building downtown. The mural is designed by Brooklyn-based artist Jan Testori and will be one of the artistic centerpieces in a plaza at the heart of the Canby Civic Block, which is anchored by the new Dahlia building on the corner of 2nd and Ivy. We got the chance to chat with Arturo Gonzalez, one of the local artists working on the piece. He said he's used to painting houses, but he likes doing flowers a lot more. All right, so I'm here with Arturo, one of our painters on the new Dahlia mural that's gone up. Arturo, you want to say hi?
Hi, good evening.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Good, good.
Yeah.
So where are you from, Arturo?
I'm from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
My friend Eric, he's from Mexico as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we live in Beaverton. We're hoping our friend Mary Hendlin painting this mural with the one who built this condominium,
right.
Apartments.
The Dahlia apartments.
The Dahlia apartments.
So this was designed by an artist out of New York, and they tell us about the process of how it works. They give you a grid that you work off of. That's how you do it?
Yeah, so the designer gave us the plans, and she asked for a 1 foot square grid. And
she tells you what colors to do and stuff? Or?
She got all the prints.
Yeah.
Each flower has different colors.
Yeah.
And different design.
Yeah. You were saying you and Eric, you get to use a little bit of your own creativity, right, with some of the lines and a little bit of what you think will look good, right?
Yeah, we're trying to give them different kind of lines and thickness to make the flower pop out a little bit more.
Well, I know we're part of this Facebook page called Canby Now. That's where we get our name from. And people have been posting pictures all week of your guys' work, and everyone's really happy with it, just thinking it looks awesome. What do you think about that?
I think that's great that people are talking about this mural. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. Cool. So what has it been like for you doing this? You said that you normally have a background kind of just in painting houses and stuff, so this is a little bit different for you.
Yeah, sure. This is our first mural painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got like around 12 years of experience painting houses and big constructions. And
most houses don't make you paint giant flowers on them?
No.
Okay.
Most of the painting on the houses is just body and trim.
Gotcha. But I bet this is kind of fun to work on, huh?
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, it's fun painting flowers. Plus, you don't get bored. It's really nice.
They're all different, all different colors, different designs.
Yes. Yeah.
Unlike a house.
Not like the houses. Yeah, this is cool. Not a boring house that you're painting.
Cool. Well, if I ever paint my house, I'm going to do it in flowers, I think. Might hire you guys to do it.
You should paint some flowers on the side of your house.
I want like flowers and like a giant dinosaur, I think, like rampaging through the flowers. Would you guys do that?
That'd be cool. Yeah, we will.
Yeah, cool.
If you ask.
All right, thanks, Arturo. And that's our show. I'm your host, Tyler Franke. Our producer is Tyler Clausen. Special thanks to our guests today, Jim Sherwood and Pacific Giant Vegetable Growers. Hey, if you liked what you just heard, please let us know. Write a review for us on Facebook, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss our latest episodes. If you're looking for our sports report, it now appears in its own mini pod, Canby Now Sports. You can find it in our regular channel along with this episode. Be sure to catch our show Thursday. We'll be talking with Scott Anderson, a magician whose talents have been seen around the world, both on stage and in the army hospitals in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which he once served. He'll tell us about the time he even upstaged Robin Williams. If you have a news tip, an idea for a guest we should invite on the program, or suggestions for how we can improve, please connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at CanBeNow or on our website, canbenowpod.com. Thanks for listening.